Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is the winner of this year's Peggy Helmrich Distinguished Author Award, given by the Tulsa Library Trust. Wendell Berry is this year's recipient, who has spent his career exploring man's relationship with the land in over 50 works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. Berry is a third-generation farmer in northern Kentucky who has been an ardent conservationist throughout his life, and that theme has informed nearly every part of his writing. From his most famous works, his Port William novels, his fictional universe set in a northern Kentucky town that echoes his real-life Port Royal community, with novels like Nathan Coulter, Jaber Crow, Hannah Coulter, and Andy Catlett, Early Travels. He's also depicted the Port William community in numerous short stories. He has over 25 collections of poetry and numerous nonfiction works on everything from the loss of America's agrarian lifestyle to land conservation and environmentalism to politics, religion, and literary criticism. Berry has been the recipient of numerous awards and honor and gave this year's National Endowment for the Humanities Jefferson Lecture in the Humanities. He'll have a public presentation and book signing this Saturday morning at 10:30 at the Central Library at 4th and Denver. Wendell Berry joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Wendell Berry, welcome to Studio Tulsa, and congratulations on the Helmrich Distinguished Author Award.
Well, thank you. I'm very grateful.
I want to ask you about Henry County, Kentucky. This is where your parents came from, both sides of your family, up five generations, I think. It's where you live now?
Longer than that, really. It goes back to the first years of the 19th century, at least.
Mm-hmm. And this land has had a tremendous impact on every bit of your writing, from essays to your poetry to your novels, which are set in a fictional Port William. Port Royal is where you live nearby. This has been the land that's been your creative force. Can you describe that connection to it?
Well, it's the only place I really knew in my formative years. And then after a few years of traveling about, mainly in the early years of our marriage, we came back here. And since then, it's been the place I've known, of course, better and better all the time, and have thought more carefully about all the time. So this place has been necessarily my subject, because I've been here more than in any other place.
It takes a unique eye, though, to see the very familiar and see the interestingness of a place. What do you ascribe that to?
A long time and a certain amount of patience and a certain amount of guidance. I grew up with people who knew how to look and helped me to learn what to look for and at, and gave me some notion of standards to use in looking. Know that it's any special gift. You do have to keep looking. When we were living in New York in the early 60s and decided to come home, there were people who, friends of mine, literary friends, who thought I already knew this place as well as it could be known. But from the perspective of this much additional time, I know that they were wrong. I'll never know it as well as it could be known.
Well, I think knowing some place as a youth and knowing some place as an adult, that seems like there's a big gap between those two.
Well, there is a big gap. Places have a kind of charm before you have an adequate vocabulary to describe them, before you know all the species of the trees and other plants and the birds and the animals. As travelers know and experience over and over again, ignorance gives charm to places. Distance gives a certain charm. And then you begin really to learn and to acquire a vocabulary and a critical eye to see what's happened and what has gone wrong, what's been done right. Some of the charm goes away, maybe, but then it's replaced by experience and history that's finally mutual. And the investment, the personal, intimate investment of life and time and work in a place. And all this is finally more enriching than that early sort of mythologizing charm that a place has on you when you're a child.
You mentioned people who helped guide you. Obviously, I would think one of those people was Wallace Stegner, who wrote about the West in such a way
yeah.
which people thought the West was not worth writing about. And a lot of his disciples have also sort of reinforced that everywhere is worth writing about. Give us a sense of what he imparted to you that made Henry County, fictional and nonfictional, the center of your universe, your writing universe.
Well, of course, when I went to Stanford in 1958 as a Stegner Fellow, I was 24 years old and had no idea of the shape that my life and work were going to take. So I really wasn't prepared at that time to understand and appreciate Mr. Stegner's fidelity to the West as a writer and as a citizen conservationist. It was oddly only after I had made up my mind to live here and assume the kind of responsibility to my place that he had lived out and written out to his own region that I began to appreciate him and understand what his commitment had meant. So that his influence on me as a teacher lasted really until now, but it increased over time. He was a good teacher. He was the kind of person whose mere presence made you feel that you ought to be at work.
That's good. Am I right in thinking that in the couple of years you were out there that you were surrounded by a lot of really good writers? I think Ed Abbey was there at the time. Was he
no,
there?
No.
Oh, no. No,
no. That chronology is often confused. Ed Abbey was there the year before I was. And I never actually met Abbey. We exchanged letters, brief cards and letters over the years. And were sort of ready to meet. He would made a trip east and said he would come by here, but I think he was too sick at that time, actually, to be able to do that. So we never met. And then the people of note, of reputation, who were there at the time I was there, were Ernest J. Gaines mm-hmm. of Louisiana. And the West Coast, and Ken Kesey, right. The people who are my contemporaries at Stanford, who people are likely to know. And then Larry McMurtry came after I left. I was there 2 years. And I think Larry McMurtry came the next year. And then my fellow Kentuckians, Gurney Norman, James Baker Hall and Ed McClanahan were later fellows and knew McMurtry and other people who came later much better than I did.
I want to ask you, you mentioned earlier Wallace Stegner as a writing teacher, but also as a conservationist. Did he open your eyes? Because, you know, a constant theme in your writing has been the change in how the family farm, you know, how it's becoming an endangered species in many senses, and how the change in farming has changed the whole world, and the urbanization of our culture has sort of gotten us away from the land. Was that something that was percolating before you met Stegner, or was this something that came out?
Yes, it had begun. I had read Thoreau, for instance, and I had read other writers who were concerned about conservation. My father, who was a lawyer, was also a farmer and also a land conservationist. And so I had all that in mind. But I didn't really become a conservationist myself until my return here in 1964. And in the next year, for instance, I saw strip mining for the first time. And I saw that the farm community was very much under threat. And the country, the rural communities, and the rural landscapes were beginning to be threatened and in some ways to deteriorate. And that sort of brought me to consciousness. And that was when I began to understand Wallace Stegner as a conservationist.
My guest today is Wendell Berry. He's a novelist, poet, and essayist, over 50 books in all, probably best known for his Port William novels as well as his collections of poetry. And he's the winner of this year's Peggy V. Helmrich Distinguished Author Award given by the Tulsa Library Trust. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I want to ask you about the origins of the Port William novels. Again, you know, you live near Port Royal. I assume that this is a very fictionalized version of, once again, Henry County. And these novels...
Well, now Port Royal is the real place.
Yes, Port Royal is. Port William
Port
is your,
William
is your
the,
fictional
is
creation.
Fiction place.
Yeah. But I would assume they reflect a lot of the themes you see around Henry County. And a lot of them... These novels are, they're interesting in the fact that, unlike maybe Faulkner, where there's, you know, there's this horrible discord, there's less of that in these novels. They're more like an arc of a life.
Well, there is discord in that long series of works about Port William. There are, for instance, two murders. There's real discord. But there's also something else, which is the realization in certain characters of what one of the characters names the membership, which he means the sharing in common of the place by the people and all the other creatures who live there. Everybody, everything, he says, we're members of each other. And the difference is not in who is and who is not, but in who knows it and who don't. Obviously some people who don't know and take no pleasure and no responsibility from their membership, but there are others who do. And that really has interested me above everything, is these friendships, alliances, commitments that have formed, marriages, and so on over the years.
And that membership, can you elaborate on what that means as far as somebody who is a non-member of the community? Is it sort of a stewardship of the place you are?
You could say it that way. I think what I've had in mind is the old neighborly associations that we used to call work swapping. Friends, neighbors, would work together in the tobacco harvest, say. And they would come together to do the crew work, the hard work, the most difficult work of the year. And as I experienced it, the rule of those associations was nobody's done until everybody's done. And at their best, they didn't involve accounting. Nobody said, you owe me 3 days now. People simply helped each other through the difficult time. And that's sort of my model for the membership, except that I've understood from my reading in writers such as Aldo Leopold, Sir Albert Howard, and others, that the membership can't be just a human membership. It has to include the other creatures. And within some of the people of Fort William, there is this growing awareness that everything has to be included. And that's been very largely the burden of my work as an essayist.
Yes, it has. I want to ask about one of your most recent essays, which had to do, it was actually your Jefferson lecture in the humanities, which you gave just this past year. It seems to be somewhat pessimistic, tempered by some thoughts of optimism about the future of the farm as you know it, and that idea of job swapping and work swapping. Does that still go on today, for example, work swapping? Does that still happen today?
No, that's pretty much gone now.
Yeah, and this essay is about, you know, the industrialization of the farm, the fact that you don't need a lot of people on the farm today, and most of the young people have gone, and we're losing something essential in that connection between man and land.
Well, I've lived through the replacement of most farmers by machines and other technologies. I don't think that's well realized, but it is a fact. And the rural landscapes are now virtually deserted. Fewer people at work in them, and fewer local people taking pleasure in them. The relinquishment of what I would call country pleasures is really pronounced here, and I think in other places. And the most noticeable thing is you don't see young people outdoors anymore, fishing, swimming, hunting, picnic, and doing the other things that people always did. They seem to be indoors now, or in cars, but entertaining themselves, I assume, electronically.
Well, and that this essay points out that whole theme. And one of the things
the title of the essay is taken from a 1910 novel by E.M. Forster. It all turns on affection. And the risk that lecture seems to take is to say that everything depends on affection or on love. People take care of the things they love. But that isn't quite as risky or as far-fetched as to assume that people will take care of things that they don't love.
One of the things I took away was, I think, the ideals of our country is this is a country of mobility.
Yes.
And I don't think you subscribe to the idea that is an ideal of our country, the idea of I suppose, of being able to do that. That's good. But you feel like mobility, there's more to learn about one little piece of land than you probably can spend a lifetime doing.
Yes. Well, the practical argument for that is that the knowledge of the place you're using is an asset. And the best farmers, the best foresters I've met are people who understand that over time, the knowledge that's gained and then passed on about the local land using economy is a precious economic asset, because it not only instructs about how to make the land productive, but also how to maintain the land in production so that you're not using up the principal in order to accumulate an annual interest, so to speak.
As you write in the essay, the idea that so many of the young generations on the farm have left the farm, that knowledge is being lost.
Yes, it's being lost very rapidly. And in some ways, it's already gone. And so the question is how you stabilize the relationship how you establish a relationship between the land and the people, which is to say between the human economy and the local ecosystems. How you establish and maintain that is a critical question that isn't being addressed, so far as I know, by the politicians or by most economists. I know one economist who is really very careful to think about this issue of the relationship between land and people, but most economists that I read in newspaper articles, magazine articles, columns, and so on, are really not talking about the economy, which is the way people live in relation to their life supports. They're talking about what I would call a financial system, which is something altogether different.
Mm. And
and which can destroy the economic basis of human life.
You bring up some interesting points about this whole idea of thinking about the farm in a different way. And really, when you think of the consumer of farm products, you know, two generations ago, we knew a lot more about how these products ended up on our table. Now, I would think, except for the small little urban market conditions, the farmers markets system,
yes,
where you have local growers growing stuff, most Americans are fairly removed from the idea of what it takes to put grocery items on grocery shelves.
Yes. Well, that's true, and most is still the correct modifier there. But in a remarkably short time, these farmers markets and other points of connection between rural producers and urban consumers have increased at a very respectable rate, and people are learning a lot. They are beginning to relearn where their food comes from and how it's produced and at what cost to humans and to nature. So this is happening. It's the destruction is going on still and probably increasing. But at the same time, this other movement has begun to happen, and it's being very well represented and spoken for by younger writers such as Michael Pollan and Bill McKibben and Eric Schlosser, Barbara Kingsolver also. This sort of awakening is happening, and it's a source of hope. I don't talk about optimism and pessimism. I do talk about hope and what its authentic grounds might be. And there are now, as there always have been, authentic grounds or supports for hope.
Hmm. Well, we look forward to getting to hear more of your work. We haven't even talked about your poetry, which is wonderful as well. Can you give us a sense of how you divide your work between work on the farm and work with the pen? Because both are time-consuming efforts.
Yes. Well, people often ask me that, and the implication always is that I must have found a way to balance it out. And the honest answer is that I haven't found a way to balance it out. I get most of it done. I'm always behind in my work, but I get it done by what most needs doing at the moment. And that's far from a balanced or an orderly way to go about it.
So at planting and harvest time, less riding, maybe during the winter a little more riding?
Yes, that's true. Now, I don't plant and harvest very much. My farm is now, except for the garden patch, permanently grassed or permanently in woodland. So I'm not planting and harvesting much. My son lives nearby. And getting hay and grain from my farm is a complicated business on a very small scale. And it's easier for him and easier for me, too, that I just buy the little hay and grain that I need from him.
Well, we'll ask him one
last... You're right. Once the growing season starts, there's a compulsion that the winter frees you from. And so I do work more at the indoor part of my life in the winter.
Now, are you working on a novel this year or essays or poetry? Or is that all interchangeable depending on your mood?
Well, the poetry comes along on a more occasional in a more occasional way. If a poem comes to me, then I work on it. But poems don't always come. The essays and the fiction are more long-term projects, more deliberate, and I give more deliberate work to those things than I do to poetry.
Mm. You still write in longhand, right? That's how your drafts are done?
Yes.
And you have somebody transcribe the work, basically. That's amazing. That's how you still work in this day and age.
Well, I don't see anything amazing about it. It's how I learned to do it. How virtually everybody did it when I started out.
This is true.
And it's a completely satisfactory way to me. And if I'm satisfied with the way I'm doing it, I don't see any reason to change. So I don't change.
Well, congratulations on the Peggy Helmrich Distinguished Author Award. We're all looking forward to your appearance here in Tulsa. Wendell Berry, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
Wendell Berry is the winner of this year's Peggy V. Helmrich Distinguished Author Award, given by the Tulsa Library Trust, author of over 50 works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. He'll have a public presentation and book signing. He'll receive the award Friday night. The public presentation will take place Saturday morning at 10:30 at the Central Library at 4th in Denver, and it's free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime to listen on demand at publicradiotulsa.org. Just search for Studio Tulsa, and then you can search our archives for past programs. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.